We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is the Gator Nation Football Podcast with your hosts, Alan Williams and James DeVirgilio.
Now we know we're just a bunch of average stiffs.
Welcome back to the Gator Nation Football Podcast. We are smack dab in the middle of the offseason, but it is March, Allen, one of our favorite times of the year. As both you and I are huge basketball fans, we spent our entire weekend watching virtually every single game at my house with a plethora of our friends, as we do every year. So here we are now to talk about college football and also some basketball.
Yeah, but Allen,
how are you feeling on this March Madness Monday?
Loving it. Obviously, I would have liked a different result on Friday, but these are some high holy days, you know. They're awesome. I love March Madness weekend. It's a great time of year. I love the March mailbag, too.
Yeah, and if you were a degenerate like me, you stayed up till the very end of the game last night where Texas A&M had a thriller versus Houston. Yeah. Houston had a ton of guys foul out. It was a zany game. They had a fourth-year walk-on make a free throw at the end of the game because they were out of players.
Amazing.
It was nuts and also amazing. Also, hopefully amazing is our content. And if you like this content, then follow us on social media, sub to our YouTube channel for film reviews, and become a patron on Patreon where you too can drop us a dono. You can also hit up our GNFP Sammy and GNFP Java Discord threads. The Sammy is on WhatsApp, and of course the Discord thread is on Discord. Also, check out our merch, which you can year-round. Now, check out the gear that we have if you enjoy that. Hit up that website. Links are always in our podcast description, no matter where you get your podcast from. And a shout out to one special listener who's brand new, Mary Jammin' Jones.
It's a great name.
It's one of our friends. It's her mom. So shout out to you. I couldn't help but see an email from Mary Jammin' Jones and think that's got to be one cool mom out there. And clearly, Mary, thanks for listening to the show. We appreciate you. And we did have one medium dono here, an off-season dono from Michael Moscone.
Let's get it.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Appreciate you coming on board in the sort of the doldrums, if you will, of the off-season here. But we are here, Alan, with spring football practice.
Yeah.
And we still have a king sitting on the throne, Barry Jenkins.
His name is Barry Jenkins.
Out there in L.A. Salute. Yeah, right? Presiding over a never-ending summer, I'm sure, out there where the weather's perfect.
Glorious. Okay, let's talk about the rest of the legends here. James Ridge, Guy Templeton, Cooper and Kylie Craig, Jason Walker, the big homie, Lil Peyton, Constantine 00, Alexander Leventhal, Diego Rivera, Bill Hood, James New, Nathan Jeter, Stashmi, Bobby Boucher, Frank Marcellisi, Mike Wechter, Tim Kaine, Nicholas Isaac, Mike, Mark Jackson, Tim Hondrick, James Truitt, Gus O'Leary, Brad Wilson, Mark Mitchell, Chris Folsom, Dr. Matthew Galloway, Jamie Galliano, Aaron Jeter, Jason Landry, Michael Reeves, Jason Johnson, Zach Sparks, Mark Rubenstein, Tyler Romney, Craig Scrotto, Alan Horn, Sydney Singleton, Kristen Moody, David Sugar, Percy Harvin, baby, and Doug and Lynn DeVirgilio. Let's get to it. March mailbag. You ready?
I'm so ready. I love this episode.
Yeah, it's fun.
We do a March and a May mailbag because, you know, you need two mailbags, one before spring practice and the game and then one after. And here we are getting to all your questions. And first, I guess, a bit of news here, Alan, we should hit the people with since it's been a minute since we've been on the air.
Yeah, there's not too much going on in the line. I think this is all the headline news we missed. The Gators hired a second O-line coach, meaning replacing our old secondary O-line coach, Jonathan DeCoster, who'd been with the Browns. Fairly nondescript resume, just an NFL guy who has some ties to Louisiana. I have no opinions on him or his hire.
Hasn't been an O-line coach before.
Yeah, kind of in, not as a head guy or anything like that. Has some experience. Was an O-lineman, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, could be great. I have no idea. Billy did double down on the two offensive line coach plan. He had a chance, obviously, to reshuffle that with Stapleton leaving, but he's persevering with the course.
Yeah, stay the course. We'll talk plenty about coaching in this ep, so we'll leave that there for now. And then Miles Graham, the four-star, highly touted linebacker that comes into the program, had a existing issue health-wise. They tried to see if he was going to be able to kind of get right. Couldn't get right, decided to fix it for the long term. It is a back surgery, and I think when anyone hears back surgery, you think, oh no, that could be really bad. Team seems confident he'll be good to go for fall practice and fall camp. So,
yeah, right decision if that gets him ready to go for the fall.
Correct. And with that, we enter into the mailbag, and I'm going to open up the first one. I've got a friend of the program and also personal friend, Jay Fant, who wanted to say in person to me, this was his question, can you talk about positive stuff this ep? It's so depressing with the looming season ahead in so many people's mind. And I said, of course, in the mailbag, that's what's great. There's all sorts of positive things and negative things and whatever else to discuss. And we're going to start with some positive stuff, at least in your eyes and my eyes, Alan, and that's basketball.
Yeah.
Where we did get some questions. I'll open up the bidding here with Scott Stoll. He's still in basketball mode. We're still in basketball mode. And he says, it feels like Todd Golden might be a home run. Evaluate this season here, year two for Todd.
I loved it. So much fun. Again, I'd rather have a team that loses 102, 100 rather than loses 65, 63. I'll take that into the spectrum. Obviously, I would like my team not to give up 100 points, but I felt like this team was really likable. I like their style of play. The decisions that are being made make sense. Even there was some tough stuff. You know, the Riley Kugel-ness of it all was challenging. You know, we don't know exactly what's going on with him, but he's supposed to be the player, and the team had to weather the stretch where he moved from featured guy to bench guy and came out on the other side. You know, playing really well. I love the young guys. I love the young forwards. The guys that took in the portal this year were excellent. You know, especially the headline guys. Obviously, took a couple guys at the end who were not really playing, but just filling out the roster. But Pullen and Samuel were great. Handlockton was a nice find for us. Clayton was obviously excellent. So I think the arrow is definitely up on Todd Golden. He's the second youngest coach in Power Five. If he can continue to put it together here, you know, and again, this is a crazy time in college basketball, just like it's a crazy time in college football. I think we have a guy who could be here for a long time and coaching at a really high level.
Yeah, might be a home run is well said, Scott. He might be a home run. And right now, obviously, his trajectory is positive and trending in the right direction. And to me, this season was a home run, even though we didn't win an NCAA tournament game, did not win the SEC tourney, finished sixth in the SEC. We went from losing virtually our entire roster. And again, put your mindset back into the end of last season.
Murky.
Didn't have a good season. We lost basically everyone. And you're like, we are probably screwed. And he reconstructs an entire roster and puts together the sixth best offense in the entire country, which offense gets recruits. Let's put it out there. And he's also a very savvy, I think, X's and O's coach. He's aware that defense needs fixing this year. He's been a good defensive coach historically. I think it's a great showing. I think the players like him. I love him. He's quick-witted. He's authentic. He answers questions accurately. He assesses things correctly. He feels like he fits the Florida brand. He feels Floridian in the sense of the University of Florida and the melting pot that it is. He blends right in there. And again, I think this team was so much fun to watch, which we talked about all year long. And ultimately, I think could have made a deep run. And Todd said so as well. He said the hard thing about this was this team was capable of making a deep run. And they were because they could have beaten really anybody on the right night. And unfortunately, Colorado had an historic night. Florida did not play good defense in that game. But even then, Colorado made every shot for a right. while there.
They had supreme efficiency and Florida still
almost won that game. Right. Bigger. And it was a lot of fun to be back in March. And I do think, again, the arrow for me for Todd is way, way up. We had said that as this year was going on. We're going to find out now what happens next year. Who can he retain? Who do we pick up? But it certainly seems like if you're betting on the trend from the outside, this could be just the beginning for a guy who's got a lot going for him in an era of basketball that no one has really quite figured out yet. So for Todd to very quickly do a wholesale turnover, I think gives him a branding advantage in the portal this year. And we're going to see, but he should be able to be at the table with big time players saying, look what I accomplished last year with these guys out of the portal. I can do the same for you. And I think Florida's basketball brand is and has been re-put back on the map. We didn't stamp major awareness like an Elite Eight run might have done, but I think people are recognizing that, okay, a team that's been historically so successful in the modern era is potentially coming back mm-hmm. into the mainstream, and I couldn't be more excited. All right, second question here from Guillermo Batista. Is Todd Golden's success enough to afford Scott Strickland another opportunity to hire a football coach if Coach Napier ultimately fails?
You know, this is going to be a complicated question. We're going to get to some AD talk later in the show. I don't think so necessarily. I mean, maybe if we'd won a national title or something. Football is still the king, and rightfully so. It's the big money revenue sport. I think men's basketball is popular here. It's important here after, you know, the Billy Donovan era, but not necessarily. There's a lot of, like, again, this is a really hard time to be an AD as well. So I don't know. I don't know what are the factors in Scott Strickland staying a year or 10 years or 20 years or what. I don't think this necessarily moves the needle enough. If you want to keep him, that's good news for you. If you would like to fire him, it's probably, and Todd Golden's great, it's probably not enough to reverse that
mindset. Yeah, I think that it's a factor, though.
Yeah.
And yeah, is it enough solely by itself? I mean, to evaluate the AD's job requires, right, multiple things to look at. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of channels you must evaluate, and we'll talk a little bit about this more in depth in the AD segment. So don't worry if this answer feels a little lacking in depth. We're going to hit hard kind of when would you fire an AD and what do you look for? But I do think this does matter. I think hiring a basketball coach, having this kind of success, and look, ultimately, we had it down to kind of two that we felt like fit Florida's protocol. The other guys at LSU did not have a good season, did not make the tournament. Todd has thoroughly outperformed him over the two-year subset here. That's a win, mm-hmm. obviously, versus a program I think we're comparing ourselves to. They hired Brian Kelly in football, right? We didn't. I do think it does matter, though. I think at the very least, Alan, what it does is it, if you feel like, okay, it was a huge failure to hire Napier, and then Todd Golden becomes, let's say, like a top 10 basketball coach, he hired those guys within a few weeks, you know, months apart from each other, right? So you might say, well, you know, well, does that mean he gets another shot, another bite at the apple? And I think the answer ultimately could be yes. I do think, though, I will say this, if Golden and Napier both washed out after a three-year period looking very poorly, that's probably enough to write your death warrant, even if, as I've covered before, they weren't necessarily bad hires on paper. And so I do think in that regard, the contra narrative is pretty interesting that, like, yeah, that probably damns him. And so therefore, if Golden is successful, it probably also helps him, the magnitude of which will depend on a variety of other factors that I think are going to occur this season. And we're going to talk a lot about that with largely, I think, to be candid, how Scott handles what happens with the football team this season. I think that is going to largely move perception for him. Does he hitch his wagon entirely to Billy Napier no matter what happens? Or does he become a more active AD where if things start to go south, he begins to say, hey, I've got to separate from this as well. I've got to see what's best for the direction. I think that's also going to determine his fate. And again, we're going to get into that a little bit later. So we'll pause there for now. Let's change gears to coaching, Alan. Hit us with our next question here.
All right. 00 himself says, are you as concerned as I am that we don't have a dedicated offensive coordinator calling plays and not Billy Napier?
Well, obviously. I don't even need to answer this question too long unless you're brand new to the podcast. We've covered this extensively. And of course, one of our major concerns for this football team is that we have a guy with a long track record in Billy Napier of, I'm just going to call it what it is, mediocrity on offense. That's what it's been. And that's not ideal, I think, again, in the state of Florida, where people are offensively minded. It's a mismatch to be there. We don't have one. We have a lot of confusing triplicate, it seems like now, responsibilities with what's happening with Sale and Napier and then also Callaway. You have three guys in that room that are doing something related to coordinating or calling plays, and we don't even have any details yet. So we don't know exactly how it's shaking out, but I am concerned. It's an area of concern, even though our offense did end the season on an uptick last year. It got better, which was welcoming. We noted the changes on film review. It's definitely still a concern that we don't have like a clear hierarchy, and we're not even sure what really is happening yet.
So there were two paths ahead of Napier, I think, if you wanted to make changes. And clearly he felt like changes needed to be made to the infrastructure of the coaching staff on the offensive side of the ball as well, without making wholesale changes. So, you know, kind of at least the most obvious line of thinking to our minds of two options were, one, Billy divests himself of some of the offensive play calling and focuses more instead on infrastructure overall, more CEO type program management. Or I think the path that he chose was, I'm going to lessen some of the things on my plate, like personnel wise and some other things, and I'm going to bring in somebody else. I don't know, bring in is maybe the wrong word, elevate somebody else in like Russ Callaway to help me do this. And again, this could be largely semantic. Like it's a pay bump and you are in the room, but you don't say much. Or maybe Callaway has a lot of influence and Napier is the one hitting the button to call the play, and Callaway is doing a lot of the design. That would be a significant change, right? And that could lead to better offensive production. They're going to get a chance to show it on the field. The numbers need to be better for Florida to get to where they want to go. And they're, you know, the offense isn't bad. It's just not, it just seemed to be suboptimal at times. So I like that there was a step made. There are enough differences that would give me enough like wiggle room to go, yeah, the outcome could be different. We're not just straight running it back.
That's what
I don't know if I would call myself optimistic, but I am lightly hopeful.
Yeah, there was some change, mm-hmm. even though very small, not seismic, not big, but there's something. If you
it could be. We don't know.
Right, but I mean, you didn't bring in like a well-established top
sure.
level.
No,
see, that would be a seismic yeah. shift, right? You have something small, but to your point, you don't have the same exact thing. So if the hopium is there, you can drink it and go for it. But I think the ultimate answer is, yeah, everyone is concerned about the structure of Florida's program. We're going to find out what it looks like, and then we'll know, right? We'll analyze and we'll see. A few weeks into the season, we will know. Is this different? Is it the same as calling the plays? How does this look? But for right now, certainly still concerns on the offensive, you know, coordinating front.
Okay, what grade would you give Napier so far on overall coaching hires?
I'm going to answer this two
this
ways.
From Chris.
Yeah, Chris. For one, Chris, I'm not going to give a grade because you have to see how they coach. That's one. But two, on paper, perception-wise, and this is not analytical as much as just perception, marketing, etc. And we talked about this. I kind of went on a little mini rant two or three podcasts ago, like, you know, who are these guys? And a lot of them have ties directly to Billy, and they're not guys that are going to wow you. And oftentimes when you hire assistants and whatnot, even at big programs, you're not going to like, wow, that guy's incredible per se. They're coming up the ladder. You're counting on your coach to identify talented coaches. And that's where I say, we're going to find out. It's very possible that this coaching staff is going to be an upgrade. Look, Billy was as effusive in praise as ever a couple of days ago when he broke down some questions for the media, and he mentioned multiple times how he really felt like the staff was an upgrade in many facets. And so he certainly feels like he's got something better. And obviously it's a 3-year test for a reason. I'm going to hope that we have something better. But again, if you're just looking on paper, it's like, all right, these are just guys for guys. I don't see any obvious reason to believe that they're better per se, outside of obviously a guy like Ron Roberts, who's got a long-term pedigree,
mm-hmm.
Had largely been successful at Auburn minus one horrific play versus Alabama. Imagine if they closed that game out. How do you feel about Ron Roberts? Look at his body of work at Auburn. Pretty good. So that was obviously, I think, a guy who's got a lot of experience, has done a lot, and we'll talk more about him in a second. But I think so far for me, I'm going to give him a C on the hires because there's just not a lot of splash in there. But in reality, let's ask this question next year when we see how they were and we see what it looks like on the field. And then we will know, or is anything different? Are things cleaner? Are things better? Operationally, are we better? And, you know, I don't know. I'll mention one guy, though, special teams, obviously. Having someone that came from the NFL, from a Patriots team where they do a lot of things on special teams that are known as smart, seems like a immediate and obvious upgrade. That one seems like an upgrade.
Right. I don't think, you know, if you're having a successful program, like who you hire is your – cornerbacks coach is probably, it's never going to make waves, right? You're looking for an up and coming guy who's going to recruit and who's going to help your team out. You know, unless you're Nick Saban, you're running the rehabilitated coaching factory. You don't often have like defensive coordinators running your, you know, position groups. We had that last year in Jay Bateman, and there was some mixed reviews on him. So it doesn't always even work like you want it to. I think sometimes it's, you want to make a splash, like you want to hire a stud DC. Napier made somewhat splashy hire in terms of the profile of the guy he hired as his youth last year in Austin Armstrong. But yeah, I don't think your second offensive line coach is going to move the needle. That's not a place where you bring in a big gun. And if you are, he wouldn't be the second offensive line coach. So I don't know. It's hard to get too high or too low on this because there's just not enough data to say this is great or this is not great. They'll play a part in what we see on the field. And ultimately, you know, Napier's got to, it's going to be judged on him, you know, that the win-loss record is going to be on him, not on the defensive backs coach.
Yeah. One important thing to note, which we'll touch on in the AD segment, is these guys have 2-year contracts. So we had said from the beginning that we felt like Napier was going to get 4 years. That was what we said in year one. Not by our choice, but that's likely what they were going to give him. And everything is set up for that. And again, we'll address when you wouldn't do that if things got bad enough. And hopefully, again, they get good enough. It doesn't matter. But that is, they are here for a 2-year gig. So these guys, if you're hiring them, they're jumping onto Florida thinking, we're going to turn this around. Billy's going to turn it around. We got 2 years to prove it. And if we hit hard, we're going to get extensions and we're going to be here for a while, right? That's what they're looking at.
Or so they're going to move up.
Or they're going to move up. And obviously at Florida, even if you fail in 1 year on your resume, it's probably not going to hurt you too badly. So interesting to look at, like, why would a coach come to Florida now? And that's why I think you kind of see the profile of guys. We take it a lower level, not necessarily perfectly fitting, but for them, even if it's a 1-year deal, I think they look at it saying, this probably still helps me. All right. Justin Wood asks, your thoughts on Russ Callaway and what you're hearing out of spring practice about him.
So Russ Callaway, I mean, he's a somewhat known commodity. We've been talking about him in the abstract for a couple of years. Like, this is a guy on staff who has previous offensive coordinator experience. Here's what his teams look like. Ran a very different offensive system than what Napier has traditionally favored. I like incorporating him. If you're not going to go out and hire like a name OC, right? If that's not what you're going to do, you know, they didn't just say, we're going to do it, and they gave him some influence. I think they are signaling that they're going to give him more influence. They could have just, you know, say, hey, we're going to, you know, lean on Russ a little bit more. They didn't have to give him a title bump. He wasn't necessarily going anywhere, I don't think. But that is, they are signaling that they are going to, there's going to be changes made. We'll see. I have no idea what that's going to be like. I'm interested to see in the fall what comes of that. In terms of what we're hearing out of spring practice, you know, we haven't delved deep into, like, well, you know, talk to people and seeing what's going on. You can read spring practice reports. And here's what I think my thoughts on spring practice reports is, just generally take them with a grain of salt.
Fluff. A lot of fluff.
They're fluff, right? Everyone looks good. Everybody's working harder. Everyone's getting in great shape.
The media gets 15 minutes, you know, once a week generally, right, to go in and see some fluff one-on-ones and some other stuff. You really don't get a good feel.
There's some things like, you know, guys are switching positions. Guys are moving to guard. Guys are moving to linebacker. Those are notable, right? I'm interested in that stuff. But, you know, if everyone's like, Aiden Mizell looks great. No, I'm just making up something. I haven't read that or heard that. That's not bad news, but it doesn't really mean anything until they step on the field in the fall.
Yeah, that's for sure. For me with Russ, I mean, I love that he's an air raid guy. I mean, I love air raid. I think air raid principles should make up a significant portion of college football offenses when it comes to the passing game for a variety of reasons that make a lot of sense. And I hope that Florida puts more of those concepts in the playbook. And if that's what this leads to, I'm going to be very excited about it. As far as what's happening right now in spring, no one knows. In fact, the media is openly waiting to get clarification on the roles of the guys we mentioned. We don't know yet, but we'll keep an eye on that. But again, Russ himself, I love that his main background is air raid. As all of you know, I love that as a passing concept. I think it's fantastic. I think it would help us to have more of that in our system. Okay, Marshall and Kathy Gallup ask, is it realistic to think the maturity of Coach Ron Roberts will help the defense get to another level of consistency?
I think so. And they mentioned, you know, the kind of talent of the second year guys on defense, a couple of mature transfers at safety might bring better success. I think that's a narrative I can buy into, right? If you look at the defense 2 years ago under Tony, it was like, man, just doesn't look good. There's problems. There's talent issues, but there's also coordination issues. Last year with Armstrong, largely, you know, there's holes on the roster and there's things that we're not doing well, but a lot of it made sense. It even didn't work out. And obviously, defense was not great. But I can buy into a narrative that defense can move to be a relative strength of the team if these guys mature. You know, we have some holes still, right? Edge rusher, things like that. But I could buy into a, you know, if you want to sell me on the fact that defense is going to take a major step forward, I could believe that.
Yeah, it's definitely realistic in large part because of what you mentioned, and Billy's mentioned this throughout the offseason. This is a far more experienced defense, right, not only in the system, but also just snaps-wise across the board.
They were so young last year.
Correct, which will, by default, you should see significant improvement in system and snap count. Both those things together should lead to a significant improvement, along with having, and Billy mentioned this, kind of we finally got really clear, I think, you know, comments on the Ron Roberts scenario is that he is the head coach of the defense. He's going to handle most of what the head coach of the defense would do. And that Ron Roberts, and we alluded to this when we hired him, was the creator in Billy's eyes. I think that's a big word. The creator of the defense Florida runs. He did not invent this, but Billy's giving him that title. And then obviously Coach Ham was a recent understudy from him. And I think that tells you right there what's going to happen. So they're going to have Ham calling plays, and they're going to have, you know, Ron Roberts really being, by all, I think, practical purposes here, Alan, the defensive coordinator. And I don't see many other ways where that doesn't happen. If you bring the creator in to work with a pupil, the pupil is not going to be the architect behind the scenes, but you are going to let your pupil maintain a very important position, which is play calling, something I think that Coach Ham has a great feel for. We've talked a lot about it last year. Most of Florida's issues were not play calls. It was largely execution. And I think you're hoping a guy like Ron Roberts, who's coached a lot longer, can handle a lot of things that are going on there. And I think in general, we read between the lines. I think there was not continuity with that defensive staff last year, with what they were doing and how they were doing it and how they were teaching at all three levels. And I think Billy made mention already how much more continuity there is with the defense on the same page doing the same thing. So it's, I think it's easy to believe, and I think in reality, we should expect this defense to be cleaner and much better than it was last year. If it is not, it will be a wholesale failure. And to go from last year to this year with no improvement, given how many guys we did retain, would be really, really poor. So yeah, I think we should expect to have a much better year on defense.
Okay, I'll read the next one. Daniel Flood has a couple questions here. Number one, what does Billy Napier need to do in 2024 to come back in 2025? Especially in the context that some would believe after year three, AD should extend a coach to show longevity with 7 to 8 wins, guaranteeing a winning season be enough.
It's going to be how it looks, Daniel, right? How do the 7 or 8 wins look? Who are they against? But 8 wins, I think, is a slam dunk versus our schedule that he's back for year 4. 7 wins is probably 90%er, unless you have some wild, zany, weird, you know, just things that aren't encouraging throughout that season that do it. So I think, yes, in general, 7, or that seems crazy, right? But that would be a major win given Florida's schedule. You'd beat Vegas's odds. That means you probably have 1 or 2 top 25 wins on your resume there for Billy, which we don't really have now. And some wins against a rival or two. So that's important. 8 for sure, 7 almost certainly. But I think that's what Billy needs to do is I think there's not an easy path for him to just do this with style this season. We talk a lot about style. Generally, style is for year 1 and year 2. Year 3 is for results, right? You got to get results. Hard for me to see a 6-6 year where he shows enough improved style on the field that you confidently give him year 4. You might close your eyes and give him year 4 and hope that that becomes your big turnaround year. But I think, yeah, I think that 7.5 number is a good number. Like, that's the number I would put it on for Billy gets year 4. I think that's what I would need to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you offered me 8 wins right now, you know, you don't tell me what it is, I will take it. Absolutely. Close the case. We'll move on. 7 wins seems nice. I think six could do it as well. Especially there, I could see some narratives. Let's say Graham Mertz goes down in game 7, and DJ Lagway comes in and looks awesome, but plays like a true freshman, and you lose some games close that, you know, there's some freshman mistakes in there or whatever, or they're just really competitive and you're playing top 10 teams down the stretch and you're almost winning them and you maybe pull out one at the end to get to 6. I could see some really a lot of hope in that. Here's what we're all talking about. I'm going to say this again and again. We all recognize how difficult the schedule is, so we should be able to moderate our expectations. Now, if you tell me it's his overall record, I can't talk against it, but we were talking last year, let's take your average top 20 team. I think we picked like NC State. And like, let's take that team and just lift them into 2024 and run them through Florida's perceived schedule. What would we pick? We would probably pick them to go 3-9. And that's a team that finished in the top 20. So the difficulty is tremendous. There's only one game on schedule that you can go ahead and mark as a win. And yeah, I think we need to see. Billy can't go 3-9. I think that will sink him, right? It just is just not enough. But we'll see. I think there's a lot of scenarios where even 5 wins could get him back if it's the right 5 wins and it looks good on paper the rest of the way.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, another Billy question here. We're in the Billy section. This is, again, still Daniel Flood. Is it concerning that we have yet to see Billy fire a guy who worked with him at Louisiana? I don't know behind the scenes, but keeping guys like Tony until after NSD or signing Stapleton to a new contract doesn't seem like they were let go.
Yeah, we can't know for sure how these things went down, but let's put it this way, and this is something we've handled before at a strategic podcast level. To be an effective and quality leader, you have to fire people. It's not something you should want to do or look forward to do. And when you do it, you should be sad about it because it means the person you hired isn't working out. But make no mistake about it. There is not a human leader on the planet that gets their hiring right every single time, despite their best efforts. Sometimes it just doesn't work. And so if you're not willing to move somebody on, what that means is you are dragging somebody with you that is not capable of doing their job at the highest level. And that is a no bueno for what's best for the organization. So 3 years in, given Florida's struggles, given that he has not actually seemingly fired someone on his own, we can't know what happened there. So maybe he did behind the scenes. I can't know. Is of concern to me because, again, what I just mentioned is there's not a leader on the planet that doesn't recognize. It didn't work out. It was a fine hire, a right choice to hire that person. I tried them in that job and they just weren't productive. Go to the next one. It's not, there's something you shouldn't feel bad about that. Again, that's part of what's going to happen. So for me, yeah, I think it's a red flag when any leader goes 4 or 5 years without firing anyone. That largely means you're not getting the best performance. You start firing a lot of people, that's a major red flag that you're not a good leader, right? It should be as few as possible, but probably one, kind of the number I'm looking at. There probably should be one in there.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Again, the Patrick Toney thing, we'll never really know. So you could count that. You know, I think if Florida really wanted to retain him, they probably could have. I mean, he took a low-level staffer job in the NFL. Maybe he just wanted to be in the NFL. Who knows? But he did fire his probably two most high-profile, am I saying this right? He did fire his two most high-profile hirings in Coach Raymond and our defensive line coach, whose name is escaping me, Coach Chaos. That's all I can come up with in the moment. That's embarrassing to do that, right? Coach Raymond was by far your biggest chip that you pulled in, and you essentially sent him packing, right? That, again, it's not a Louisiana guy, but it's not just I can't fire these guys.
No, right. Yeah, the question, I think, is that Louisiana part.
Sure, it's and like it's only
it's
2 years in.
Or someone you, it's one, yeah, he yeah. certainly fired guys that he wasn't tied to. But like, do you have a weak spot for the guys you've known? Do you
potentially
feel like you owe them maybe and you can't move them on?
Possibly. I mean, I think he's a human. Like, I'm sure he has more latitude for the people he's had a long-term relationship with. But again, we're only 2 years in here. It's not like it's like 5 years in and no one from Louisiana has ever been fired.
Right. And also, obviously, if Florida came out to a hot start, you wouldn't expect him to have to fire any major positions. My comment right. in light of saying, yeah, you'd expect probably have to fire somebody is if your production is not there, right? That's different than if you're coming killing it, you should not be firing people, you know, 2 or 3 years into your building. You should hopefully have hit home runs with your hiring. But yeah, it is still, again, year two. But certainly, I think, a yellow flag, perhaps, that the only sure. guys that went were outsiders and all the guys who stay were buddies, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we have the scars of the Mullen era in that. So something to be aware of.
Our fan base is definitely more acutely aware of those scenarios.
All right. Why don't you read the next one?
All right. Dr. Eyeball. Assuming a scenario where on-field results don't improve and Billy is fired 2/3 of the way through the season, do you think the next head coach will have a better base to build off of than Billy had when coming in after Mullen?
So there's a couple things in this question I think are really interesting. We used to think about, would a coach leave a program better off? And in the current reality, I don't think there's – you can't really control that, right? So you could have guys here and literally everyone could leave. So it's better to have more talented players in the building. But I don't know. We used to think about like, okay, he left the cupboard bare. He could leave the cupboard full and the next guy comes in and most of them leave through. That's not really totally in his control. It can be a win to keep them. But there's so many other factors with NIL and everything else that this is going to be a murky couple years in college football. So I don't know if there's a clear path forward. I think, you know, and do you fire a coach in that same timeline? The college football calendar is shifting and moving. Is it wise to fire a coach 2/3? Is it better to fire him earlier? Is it better to fire him later? There's a lot of different inflection points that we don't have data on that we're going to have to like see what does this look like? Or is it better to keep continuity? Is continuity become an even higher value when there's so much chaos everywhere else?
Yeah, that's well said. I think for me, this is going to be reductive, but the world is so different in college football. The answer to this question actually is yes, we'll have a much better base because we know what to expect
sure.
from the current college football landscape. I mean, Billy walked in at an historically difficult time to be a football coach at a major program and a new one at that, right? So many things changed and no school really knew what they were doing. Now, the next coach knows, we know what to expect. The administration knows what to expect. Whether you have new administrators or not, they know what to expect. There are things in place sure. that you can tweak and change, but you're not building something from scratch.
Yeah, but that's institutional knowledge, but not
correct.
Really knowledge.
But that's what I'm saying. So to your point, what's interesting to this question is it used to be exactly what you said. Of course, fundamentally, pre-NIL, Billy would have left a better program than Mullen. And that's kind of what your question is getting at. Absolutely, without a doubt, he would have definitely done that. There's more consistent talent across the board. Our average talent level is higher. The players that he's recruiting, I think he has far more discretion on what kind of guy they are. I think it would be better. But the world we live in, look at Alabama, is everyone can leave. And so to your point, Alan, it becomes wholesale turnover. I don't care who you are. We've already watched it happen. The best culture program on earth, Alabama, was a Wild West show, right? So yes, better because of the off the field kind of we learned some lessons here, but and also would have been better again in previous times. But I think now all those bets are off with what you look at as somebody building your program. This to me, if I'm a head coach, I'm a 1 year head coach every year. I'm a transactional machine and I'm building a 1 year team and I'm turning over 35% of my roster and I hate every second of all of that. But that is the reality of what coaching and major college football looks like now. And that means the next guy that comes in, he's transactional with probably a 50 or 55% turnover. So it doesn't matter, I think, what you really do per se. And that's well said by you.
All right. BW Pridgen, in regards to a coaching search in which only one candidate is considered and interviewed, we've seen it work once with Urban Meyer, but fail with Will Muschamp, and now appearing to fail with Billy Napier. As a leader hiring a new employee, can it be advantageous to interview multiple candidates, no matter your level of confidence in one specific individual. I think generally this process is probably true in other areas. College football is its own beast, right? So you're having to back channel so many things, right? So I don't know that you're really only quote unquote interviewing one person. When you go to talk to somebody, it is a major thing. You're not just, I'm like a person who's hiring people. I would like to talk to lots of people. When I go call Billy Napier, it's going to be headlines, right? So you have to be very selective about when and how you do that. And if you already have your guy, right, the interview is an important part. You could leave the interview and go, that guy was the biggest jerk I've ever met. There's no way I'm hiring him. But generally, that interview should just be one piece of the puzzle, right? Most of the data is going to be on the field and what they've done recruiting and, you know, what they look like as overall picture. So I don't know. This, the one interview, everyone likes to say this no matter what. Even if they secretly interviewed 10 people, they're going to say they interviewed one person. So I don't know if this is really a data point that we should hold too highly.
Yeah, it's a great point as far as how many they actually interview. But I can certainly say this in general. If you have three candidates and they're all in the same tier in your mind, you should interview all of them, mm-hmm. right? But if they're not and one is in a higher tier productivity-wise, you should interview him and make sure that he doesn't have any red flags that you think, I now need to interview a tier two candidate. If that's the process, I have no problem with interviewing one if you're getting your analytics correct. Secondarily, and quite interestingly, they've done a bunch of studies on this throughout time. And the only real factor that has any predictive success in hiring is not the interview process, not how many cool questions you ask or all the brain teasers you might get them or all the other stuff. It's actually their productivity and correlation to the job they're doing. That is it, period. So you can look these studies up, but you could basically blindfold somebody, have them have no idea who their candidate is and just look at track record and then overlay that to the job they're going to do and just select the one who's past is best with that, and you're going to get the best hire most of the time. So that being said, largely that is what's happening with college football hires. The only problem is winning college football is so completely difficult for all the reasons we've listed that your candidate generally is wrong. Most colleges hire a guy that they fire pretty quickly. So it's hard to do. But I don't think the fault is with this. I don't think these interviews are going to sway it. And again, I think we covered right the search here for Florida. And I think we also, you know, I mentioned that Lane Kiffin, who now I think would be probably the number one target for Florida if he were interested, given what's gone down at the time, was largely, as far as we know, a no-go candidate for the board and the search committee. And therefore, he was not even really potentially a guy. Now, that may change now with more time there. But when you took him out of the picture, there's other guys you can talk about. Lincoln Riley was never coming to Florida. Brian Kelly was floating his name to SEC schools for sure. Florida probably could have tried to get discussions with him. And you can go down that path. But I think in general, LSU interviewed one guy, Brian Kelly. USC interviewed one guy, Lincoln Riley. Most of these schools interview one guy. That's how it goes. It's done within 24, 40. I mean, what did Alabama do? Interviewed one guy, right? They just replaced Nick Saban, interviewed one guy. I mean, so it's just is what it is, I think, with the nature of this piece. But to your point, ideally, in a perfect world, you have three tier one candidates. You interview all of them. Absolutely, 100%. Talk to them, see what they're like, get them interacting with your staff. And even then, you may still select the wrong guy.
All right, let's move and talk a little bit predictive here, what we think about the 2024 season. Why don't you read this first one here?
Stephen Colfer asks, taking into account Billy Napier's historically bad first two seasons and his only slightly above average recruiting and portal management, what do you think the Gators' record will be in 2024?
I don't think Stephen thinks it'll be very good. I'm going to take a pass on giving a number here. Just from this vantage point, I don't think I know enough about each of the teams on our slate and how, you know. But looking at Florida's team and roster, I think the team will be better. I just don't know what that means record-wise. So I do think the player profile is better. Even the recruiting rankings don't reflect that. The portal is a question mark, obviously. We'll see what comes out of it this year. And we'll see what comes at the end of the spring. With the multi-time transfer, we could lose another 10% of our roster, or maybe you would look at gain another 10% of our roster at the end of this, depending on how it shakes out. So there's going to be a lot more movement for the Gators and for other teams. So I at least at this vantage point, I think the Gators will be better. I don't know that the record will be better. And maybe it's the same. Maybe it's slightly better. I don't know if six wins feels better. But those six wins could be momentous depending on who they come against.
Yeah, it feels like to me, you know, 60 to 70% six wins, 10% seven wins, probably 20% below six, and then, you know, remaining 10% eight and above, something like that, right? So you've got a heavy concentration around five and six, and that's based upon everything you said, taking into account what we've seen so far. That's what it's like. It's a three-year test for a reason. You can be surprised in sports. Never guarantee what's going to happen, obviously. Hopefully it will be better, but I think that's probably, you know, a likelihood of probabilities that exist out there, and obviously most of those are not super exciting. So we got a 20% chance off the cuff there with what I just said, with the season that most of us would deem to be acceptable, or at least trajectory upwards. 8 out of 10 times we're flat or disappointed. So probably something like that, which is why this year is going to be so interesting, because every game is going to be a playoff game in some respects for Florida, at least from the fans' point of view, as to whether or not we think this thing is dead or not. All right, Daniel Flood asks, is it fair to say that Florida would be in an upward trajectory and that UF should be no less than 6-1 heading into Jax in 24? That would mean that we beat Miami, also in year three, Samford, A&M, first year SEC road game, which a lot of you have probably seen the stats of just how often Florida has played A&M and how often played them on the road in comparison to Georgia, which is ridiculous. Someone explain that to me. And then we have MSU, UCF, and then Kentucky, with the lone loss possibly being Tennessee on the road. So this is the upside view of Florida's start to the schedule, another really good start to the year. Essentially, based upon all of that, Alan, based upon what Daniel's saying, is it too rosy to think Florida could be 6-1? That's sort of what we're looking at.
That feels overly optimistic. And then again, if you're thinking about the back half of the schedule, maybe you're getting even more depressed. I don't know that UF should be no less than 6-1. Like, going on the road, whether it's A&M or MSU, is tough. Miami, I know we like to downplay them. I think that's going to be a tough game, especially now that they have Cam Ward at quarterback. That feels like coin flip would be maybe too generous for Florida. Miami could suck. Who knows? But we don't have any data for them. I think you're going to have to grind out week to week. And like you said, it's going to feel like a playoff game because every one of these games you circle on and say, we need to win this game. And there's only one game on there that I feel confident at all, and that's Samford. Even Mississippi State, when you look by comparison, it looks like easy. But if we were having a normal year, I'd be like, man, this feels like the trap game where we go on the road. I mean, Spurrier used to lose this SEC West game every year, it felt like. So I don't know. There's just not a lot of room in the schedule to let down, but Florida could also win all those games, and it wouldn't, if you look each one by each one, it wouldn't be shocking. Florida could lose most of them. If you look one by one, it wouldn't be shocking either. That's what makes predicting it so hard.
Yeah. You know, you say, Daniel, that is it fair to say that if Florida's an upward trajectory, we should be no less than 6-1? And I'm going to say, yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, if you look at those teams and we are in year three and you want to give yourself any shot of being in what you consider to be like a significantly positive trend, you should be able to beat a Miami team that's similarly floundering to you. You definitely got to beat Samford. A&M, yeah, absolutely right. First year for them in their system. Mississippi State, they're down. UCF, you got to beat them. And then Kentucky is a team you just need to be able to beat. You're still more talented than they are. A lot of experience on the roster. I mean, I think so. I think the answer is yes. Now, obviously, I think what Alan answered that question was will that happen realistically? But I think the answer is yeah. Florida, if Billy has a team that he seems to think he has right now, then yes. I mean, realistically, Florida should be 6-1, given what we have on our roster. And we have a significant advantage at quarterback at Florida with a guy who knows this thing in and out and is old. That has to translate to some wins, but we will see.
All right. DL Tweet says, if Lagway is truly a 5-star plus QB, but given that Mertz proved to be a serviceable QB.
Serviceable is definitely a probably incorrect moniker there, I think, for Mertz. He was definitely more than serviceable last year.
Is there a QB controversy? Should there be one? Would you play Lagway significantly? Should Napier? If so, how soon? Example, Trevor Lawrence took the job from veteran Kelly Bryant. And then he asked a sub question here, is Miami a must-win game?
I love the shotgun questioning there.
Yeah.
Way to go. Allen, fire away.
Yeah, yeah. So Lagway could be a generationally great QB, but that doesn't necessarily mean he should start in year one. I mean, if you want to look at the Florida icons here, Tim Tebow didn't start in year one. A lot of people would have liked him to. And Chris Leak is I think that's a good comparison to Mertz, right? Veteran guy who's been there, who you trust more than the freshman play in and play out. I think Lagway will play because you want to get him ready. Just like any backup, you would like to have him ready. I think he's a way different play style quarterback than Mertz, so that affords you some leeway to get him on the field. You know, we hated some of the Trask, Emory Jones stuff. But Emory Jones is at least theoretically nowhere in the category of DJ Lagway. And also, so far, Graham Mertz has been nowhere in the stratosphere of Kyle Trask, right? So, yes, I would be fine with that. And if he is really great, if he's Trevor Lawrence good his freshman year, he should play over Graham Mertz, right? If he's that good, then yes, you play him because he's better. I don't think that scenario we're seeing. I mean, I think Graham Mertz is better than Kelly Bryant from a production standpoint. Kelly Bryant's obviously a very different player. I think there will be a QB controversy all year because Lagway is the future. Mertz is going to run out his eligibility. A lot of times when you're building for the future, you turn to the other guy. So if Florida scuffles early on, I think you see DJ Lagway because you're going to need to show that there's something different about the following year.
Yeah, nice answer there. Should there be a quarterback controversy? No, there shouldn't be. A sixth-year guy in second year in the system after the year that he had last year where you should improve as a team should be able to beat out a five-star freshman quarterback every single day of the week. Quarterbacking is significantly predicated upon experience. There is a humongous advantage to being a quarterback with experience over a guy leaving high school football. Period. Facts. I don't care how talented you are. It's a very complicated position. Essentially, it's like driving a Formula One car when Lagway is driven, like a Mustang or something around. It is such a different animal to learn that. You can't just pop right in there and do it really well. The times you see these five stars play are when you don't have a guy who really is doing much for you at all. Now, that could happen. Maybe Mertz feels pressure this season and starts to play worse. Okay, great. Lagway goes in. So there could be a quarterback controversy to which you mentioned, Alan. There will be pressure to play Lagway if Florida's season starts to go south. But in theory, this is not a Kelly Bryant scenario like you mentioned. This should be a season where Mertz plays capably and even better than he did last year. Florida's offense is able to be, hopefully, right, let's go conservative, top 50. And, not because of the quarterback, but because of other reasons held back at top 50. But obviously scoring, enough points a game to be solid that you want Lagway to learn. And then you will use him, I think, for sure in packages. He will play. I think he's going to be on the field. I think you want to find ways to get the ball in his hands. Much like, I think you gave a great example, Tim Tebow during Chris Leak's year. I think Mertz is a much better quarterback than Chris Leak, and Chris Leak won a national championship. But I think they used Tim in ways that were really helpful for the football team. And I think Billy would be very wise to do something he did not do with Anthony Richardson, as we talked about, which is create things that make a whole lot of sense for the football team and for Lagway to make this team better in some areas where Florida has struggled historically in the past. So that's what I hope to see is synergy. I want to see synergy between Mertz and Lagway in year one. Controversy means Mertz is really underperformed. That's not good for this program. So I want to see synergy. Usefulness from Lagway, usefulness from Mertz. That would be the home run for me.
Right. So there will be controversy if the team is not winning. And if Lagway looks great while he's out there, even if Mertz looks great, you're always, curious about the potential. But yes, if they're not using him, and hopefully he's ready, right? And if they're not using him in specific situations, I think that's probably a loss for the team, especially if you think about short yardage, certain elements of the field that were, putting him in the game creates difficult for the other team that they have to prepare for. All right. Chris Orr, what's up, buddy? Says, same question asked last year. What is the absolute best case scenario for the season and what has to go right to make it happen? I would say the most obviously undefeated. You know, this is a JT Raymond. The best case scenario is undefeated. The most realistic best case scenario for me is like 9-3. And what would that have to happen? All right, so the offensive line coalesces and becomes a plus unit. There's emergence of more playmakers and wide receiver. Graham Mertz plays well, is healthy all year. And the defense becomes a force, right? It goes from, you know what, they're green, they're difficult. This is a 2007 to 2008 type leap, right? Where you have the talent, all of a sudden it comes together and they become the strength of the team. Like we thought they might be at the beginning of last year. We watched that Utah game back, man, they could be really good. That wasn't the story that played out. And I think, you know, you catch some teams on some right weeks, you get a little luck, and you get to 9-3. I don't think that's the most probable outcome. But if it happened, I would be really excited about it, but it wouldn't be the most shocking thing that's ever happened. All of those things are theoretically possible.
Yeah, that's well said. I don't have much to add to that. I think the 07 to 08, 06 to 07, 07 to 08, that transfer period where you saw talent come into the program and then you saw it translate to quality immediately would be what you hope for. Florida doesn't have that kind of talent on the roster, but they do have more experience and theoretically in places upgraded talent, and that has to happen. So I think numerically you need a top 30 defense and a top 30 offense. That's what you're hoping for. And if that happens, Florida's going to win 8 games. That's what it takes. Now, the question is, do you believe Florida can have a top 30 offense, top 30 defense versus its schedule? But I think that's what it will take for Florida to win 8 games. And we'll see if that happens.
All right. Let me read the next one. Answer first.
Please,
okay.
Do it, yes.
Rooting for UF. Napier told you guys last year that his offense is much better when he has a QB in year 2 plus. What improvements would you expect in year 2 with Mertz? Good question.
Yeah, this is a good one. So I think the biggest deal for me was that Mertz had already seemed to have pretty good mastery of the offense by the end, as indicated by on the film review and here on this podcast, Mertz being very frustrated at times. The play calls aren't getting in fast enough. Things aren't happening fast enough. So my hope, if I'm a quarterback at UF, is I want to start being able, now that I'm a year two quarterback, to weigh on to the structure of the offense. Hey, why don't we do more of this here instead of this here? Because I like this look better, right? And that's what's happening anyway. Head coaches are always collaboratively working with their quarterbacks. What do you like? What do you feel comfortable with? And now that Mertz has spent time in the system, he has a leading voice, he should be automatically, reflexively able to do everything that he needs to do already. That's in his sleep. So he's spending all of his spring, all of the fall practices, honing everything. Hey, if I get cover 2 or cover 3 or cover 4, a man, or I get this kind of coverage underneath, I know I like these looks. I'm working with my receivers, and you're refining, 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 refining. So the answer is you should see the consistency within the system go up. We should see Florida being able to complete bigger passes more frequently, and we should see Florida be able to complete intermediate passes to receivers that are more open if we are able to get all of these things on the same page. So essentially, the biggest improvement should be consistency vis-a-vis communication between your quarterback, your play caller and play designer on what you like, what you see, and how you want to beat certain coverages. That's the ideal scenario.
Yeah, I think more Mertz being more comfortable with moving the team into like plays that aren't like the primary play design. But really, you know, the improvement is going to have to come from non-Mertz areas. It's going to have to come from the offensive line and the receivers, I think. I think his natural progression will take him to a place where I think he could be a really plus player. I think all the things you said, but it might not show up if the offensive line and the receivers don't also make improvements. So we'll see. And again, I think the limitations were not necessarily Mertz last year. They were scheme, design, personnel. So he could make a big leap, but it doesn't show up in the stats if the other pieces around him don't come together.
Correct, and that's largely where more of our concerns are, I think, on both of our ends. All right, Rob Blackwood asks, is there any hope for the offensive line?
Yes, I think so. There's some guys that took in the portal. There's some younger guys who could take a big leap forward. There's some decently high-profile recruits. I think you could create a scenario where the offensive line is a B, where they're productive and they're playing well. They're not like a Michigan road grade you. We're going to have 4 first-round picks on it. But I could look at those guys and concoct a scenario where they're good. Again, I could do one where they're really bad too, but I have hope for it.
Yeah, there can be hope. I think Florida's going to hopefully be an average unit. That would be a consistently average unit in the SEC. Middle of the road would be an upgrade. The hope comes in large part with some positional improvements with where guys are playing. And we'll talk about that as the season unfolds. But obviously for now, just an obvious one is a guy we highlighted all last year, George, playing tackle, who is anything but a tackle. And now he's playing guard, where I think he can actually probably be a plus guard. So he goes from a minus tackle to a plus guard, hopefully. And that's your question.
Maybe. Or he's a guy who's a decent backup guard.
Correct. And that's what the hope is. But the hope is like, okay, great. This guy now, profile-wise, could be a guard that's really quality, or he's not. And you're playing another guy. And again, we're at average. So I think average is my hope, but you can construct ways where at least it's not like, okay, we're rolling the same two guys out of tackle, same guy's a guard, same guy's a center. That happened last year. They're 1 year older. How much better can it really get? There are at least some pieces that are different with some positional changes that you can hope will improve the unit holistically. Wesley Hasek asks, will Coach Billy Napier be calling plays or Callaway? And we don't know, and no one knows. That is going to be a major question. I believe Billy will reveal this at some point. However, if I'm betting a lot of money it's going to be Billy Napier.
I feel like he's already intimated as much that he's going to be calling the plays.
Right. He hadn't said it 100% for sure, but he's going to, because we highlighted last year during SEC Media Days that his favorite thing about coaching football is calling plays. He's not giving that up. I think he's going to die with that play sheet in his hand as a coach if he does. So I'm going to go with that's my bet. But I don't think yet we know for sure the actual layout of what's happening.
All right. Nick Isaac is covering some ground we've just kind of talked about, but I'll still read the question here. Given Mertz's second year in the system, Lagway possibly being the second coming of Tebow, alongside Trey, K-Jack, Khalil Jackson, I guess. Who's that?
That's right. K-Jack's become a very popular moniker now for Khalil Jackson.
Okay.
Yeah,
there you go. Can you give me a solid James argument for the offense taking a significant step further this year in spite of the difficulty of schedule? Also, thoughts on moving George inside in the state of offensive line.
So we answered the O-line one, but I did save a little nugget here for this one. Okay. So yeah, the offense can take a significant step forward. I alluded to it earlier. If we get synergy out of those two guys. And then most importantly, if we improve the structure of the offense itself. So last year we saw the offense, although this got debated around the social media and internet world with video proof, but we saw the offense, I think, become more quality when it became structured, especially attacking man-to-man looks with route combinations, how we chose to do them, how often we employed them, when we employed them. But more importantly, I think in general, the offense needs to become much better at getting receivers open and completing easy passes for chunk yardage, period. That is something that we've struggled with. We've talked about it. We've struggled significantly with play action. I don't care how Florida does it. They've got to be more consistent at getting chunk easy yardage, right? Not behind the line of scrimmage, bubble screen stuff that we're good at. We need to find ways to reliably chunk yards to open receivers. And that can happen because hopefully you can find ways to use Lagway and Trey, right, and Mertz and your experience and what you have to be able to make that work. And so I think that is schematically, you have more chips now to work with. You got a guy in Trey who defenses are afraid of. You got a guy in Lagway who's a physical specimen. You got a guy in Mertz who's a 60-year pilot capable of running things and knows the ins and outs of your system. You got to find ways, Alan. You have to find ways to do what we called Mullen's offense every week, right? Play calling your way to points. Basically, your players are executing a perfect play call you set up. We have to find ways to do that. Mullen was a master at that. Napier has so far been almost over in that. We got to find ways to do that. And if you can do that, I think that can be a significant step forward in points on the board and big moments. Florida so far hasn't done it, but that'd be the argument for making that better.
Okay. The boys of old Florida has a question for you, James. What kind of packages would you like to see us dialing up for Lagway this year?
Yeah, I think ideally you want to see what we didn't see with Anthony Richardson often enough, right? Now, Lagway he's far more polished than Anthony Richardson ever was as a passer. They're not even really comparable with how Lagway plays the position, but he is a big, strong, fast guy. So the goal is as a play caller and designer, right? What am I looking at? What is Mertz really good at? What is Mertz weak at? What is Lagway really good at? What is Lagway weak at? And how do I play to both of these guys' strengths for my offense so that I'm getting strengths on every snap all the time and I'm not asking any one of them to play into their weaknesses? Last year with Mertz, we had no choice. If it's 3rd and 2, you can't have Mertz line up and do things Lagway can do. And so you're more limited with what you may do as an offense. If you're more creative, you say, look, I've got these resources. How, again, do I go strength? I always want strength on strength on strength versus other teams' weakness. I want to stack my strength versus their weakness. I want to play to my strengths. So I think that's the packages you want to see. So for Lagway, obviously, you're going to want to utilize him in ways Florida used Tim. And you can also combo him and have him throw more than Tim did. Tim was not nearly as polished, of course, as a passer coming in, but he was a productive passer. Lagway is an acclaimed passer who can also run. But Florida's weakness with Mertz, he can run fine, is not an inside-the-tackle type runner.
He also broke his collarbone running last year.
And also he got hurt. So, you know, I think that's how you want to do it. So I think you want to see I like to see, look, you want to dream? I want to see packages where Mertz and Lagway are in the field together. And we hit a few throwback passes to each of them. If you want to get wild with me, right? We want to run a system where they're both out there. They're both slinging the ball around. Let's get nutty. And then what three or four receivers, Alan, do you think you see having the most production this season? This is I think, hard to handicap outside of Trey. I think Dykes and automatic with Mertz and their familiarity. But how do you select the next two? That seems tricky.
Yeah, this is a giant, giant question mark. Even DK is like the transfer from Wisconsin. I mean, he has a certain floor. But I would think you would like him not to be in your top four most productive. You would like other guys to step up. I just don't think Florida has those guys. I mean, the two most obvious are Andy Jean and Aiden Mizell. They're sophomores. They were highly recruited. There's a lot of buzz about Jean in the spring. He had some injuries, some other things. Mizell never really saw the field. You would like those guys to be in your top four. If they're not, that means the offense is probably struggling. There's other guys, Marcus Burke is the only guy that really is interesting. And they have some freshman guys coming in. You know, I don't really know much about what they might do. Are they Trey and they play a lot? Are they Aiden Mizell and we didn't see him all year? I think you're probably more realistic. It's Trey, it's DK, it's Andy Jean, and I don't know, somebody else.
Yeah, Khalil Jack, obviously. I mean, Khalil Jackson is getting a lot of you know, play.
Sure.
As a guy. He got a lot of snaps last year.
A lot of snaps. So he'll be in the mix. You're right.
And I think ideally, obviously, you'd like to see two guys that were highly talked about, who you mentioned, you know, already, freshmen who become sophomores, to find a way into this rotation. I'll believe it when I see it, I think is the answer right now. I mean, we didn't see those guys very often at all last year.
And they're freshmen. That's fine.
And it's time for them to, you know, a lot of it was blocking related, play call related, route running related, right? Like, of course, if you go one-on-one shell drills, these might be the two guys you notice the most along with Trey. But when you play a football game, it's different. And I think that's why right now you're mentioning DK getting the leg up. He's played a lot of football. He's probably going to do everything correctly. He's a nice bar to have. Hey, if you want to get on the field, you got to beat this guy, right? You got to be able to do more than he can do.
He's a veteran guy. He should be very capable.
Correct.
And I think he's going to be on the field and he's going to have some production.
I think he's going to be really solid and consistent. But again, you must have more upside at that spot. And we do have guys on the roster, including freshmen. We've upgraded our speed significantly. It's a much faster wide receiving core top to bottom.
Totally.
And so you should see that on display. But I think, again, outside of the ones that are easy to pick, and Khalil Jackson, depending on how you feel about him, could be one you throw in there too.
Yeah, I left him out. But I think he's probably in a similar situation as DK. Is like,
he feels like that to us. Some people really love him, but to me on film, he doesn't create separation.
I think he's fine. I don't mind having him in the rotation.
Fine, but he's not a separation guy. Florida is dying for separation. Billy's offense literally calls for it. Hey, if you get man out there, attack that man matchup. And look, I love that mentality. But one thing we've talked about is if you're trying to run fade routes or go routes, you're not making harder than defense. More importantly, you got to have route runners who are getting open. If you get a guy who can get open, he's a good route runner. He's going to get open all the time. Give him the football. So I think what we've struggled with Florida's receivers are they're not creating a lot of separation. And we got to see that happen this year. It's got to happen. All right, let's go to Franklin Thrasher III.
Oh, we have a question from AJ here.
Oh, I'm sorry. AJ, I don't want to skip you. Schematically, assuming Napier does not change his overall philosophy, which we know is not going to happen, what are some tweaks we could see to optimize the offense? We've mentioned a lot of these already. Any further tweaks?
Yeah, just, I think it's kind of a meme here that we talk about passing concepts and, you know, making things a little easier for the quarterback down the field. I think that is a reasonable thing that could happen. If Russ Callaway has some influence, maybe that could be his influence, right? And if that can be an adjustment, you don't have to change your overall philosophy to incorporate some different concepts down the field. And so we're probably still going to run wide zone. We're still going to play a lot of tight ends. You know, that's not him changing his overall offensive philosophy, but could have some more explosive plays down the field and not just on play action shot passes, or they just happen to give us a favorable look.
Yeah, some tweaks I'd love to see, and I'm going to stick within his philosophy because, again, we've talked about my own philosophies enough in the past. But in the offense we run, I would like to see us go under center more. You know, it's sort of mystifying to me if you want to be in the Kyle Shanahan tree and you even want to run the offense Florida runs. Being under center is largely what creates the biggest problems mm-hmm. for defenses, and Florida almost never does it. And, you know, the pistol's fine. It's gimmicky. It works. It has merit. We've covered it in the film review, but being under center is far more powerful for the majority of play fakes you run. One, get under center. I don't know why. I'd love to sit down with Billy actually and ask him, like, hey, why are you not running under center more when you're, I think you would imagine you model yourself after.
Because this isn't the air raid.
Correct. Runs under center all the time and would go on record saying it's really important to be under center for XYZ reasons. Why not? I'd like to know that. But I'd like to see that. And secondarily, of course, I'd love to see us roll left. Like, again, your protege, the guy you're looking after, the father of your offense, if you will, is rolling left all the time, hitting big plays. We almost never roll left. So those are two in-system changes he could make without changing the system at all, just adding wrinkles, if you will, the same way, the same plays. So I think that'd be fantastic.
We'll see if Graham Mertz can roll left. He struggled with it a little bit last year.
Yeah, well, we barely tried it. Let's see what happens. All right.
All right, let me ask this
now,
question for
Franklin
you.
Thrasher
yeah, Franklin ahead. Thrasher III, great name. Is it crazy to think that Florida could go 9-3 if the stars align? I already answered this. What do you think?
If the stars align, it's not crazy because the stars align. And that means everything works out. It's pretty crazy to think Florida could go 9-3, but it's sports. Drink the hopium. Hope that it happens. That is extremely unlikely. I think 8 is a realistic high number. 9 would be, look, if he wins 9 games, then he will have changed his profile from dud to stud in one of the more remarkable three-year test fashions anyone's ever seen.
And Florida probably makes the playoff?
I mean, yes. I mean, that
depending
would,
on who the losses
versus,
are.
Versus what looks to be preseason, the hardest schedule ever for any college football team. And that would be absolutely believable if that happened. And I'd be here for it and celebrate it. So, yeah, I do think it's crazy to think that. But since you mentioned the stars aligning, no, it's entirely rational. All right, let's talk about Corey Amira. Quick live read break here. Corey, he specializes in design, build, custom homes. And if you are in the market for a home, Corey is your guy. He's a friend of the program, supporter of the GNFP, and he builds all different styles of homes. Country, modern, craftsman, South Florida style, Key West, etc., whatever you need. Corey builds homes in Alachua, High Springs, Gainesville, Jonesville, Newberry, Fort White, Trenton, and other places. If you need an experienced builder who can deliver what you want, Corey Amira with Amira Custom Homes is your guy. He's a second-generation contractor who spent his entire life working in construction, and he has the experience to help you execute the right game plan for your family's custom home. You can check out Corey's previous custom builds at AmiraCustomHomes.com. That's Amira, A-M-I-R-A, CustomHomes.com.
Okay, you want to read this first one?
Yeah, let's switch gears. Now we're going to tell you some AD-related questions. And the first question from Micah Sims. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Strickland's outlook and whether or not it is dependent on Billy Napier's success.
So here's a good moment just to jump in and talk about maybe what an athletic director's job is. And there's a lot more than just hiring and firing football coaches. Now, that is probably the thing that most people know you for. And so that can get you fired, certainly, if the right people line up behind you. There's a lot of administrative duties. There's the modern AD is also a fundraiser. That's maybe chief on his list, right? There's leadership of all different kinds of sports. And obviously, Florida has a big profile, big portfolio of really high-end sports. Yeah, Scott's had some controversy with some of his hires or just some things that have happened. I don't know if it's totally tied to Billy Napier's success, but let's say Billy Napier does go 9-3. Well, he's not getting fired. I don't know what this would be surmising what the boosters and the big money people and the board of trustees thinks about Scott Strickland and what is their relationship to him. Obviously, you know, we've had a good relationship with Scott. Like, he's been very friendly to us and come on the podcast and things like that. And we were fans of the Billy Napier hire. Like, well, this is the guy we said he's on the short list and maybe even at the top of the list of what would seem like the most rational, reasonable person to hire. So you can be wrong, obviously, about that. That could turn out to be, you know, not the best hire, but I think the process was in place to hire a good coach. So I like the way Scott Strickland thinks about things. I like the way he approaches things. I think he's a good ambassador. But that might not matter if enough people line up behind him if Billy Napier crashes and burns.
Yeah, I think it's not dependent on Napier's success, in large part because from what I know, Scott did not put his neck out to the search committee and say, this is the guy that I want. And the search committee say, oh, we're not really sure. It was a pretty unanimous decision from what I understand. So one reason you have search committees is to prevent your AD from going rogue on their own and then doing something that not everyone agrees with. And also it protects the AD from being like, you know, man, I hire a guy that may look good on paper, doesn't work, and now I'm fired. You don't want to overly fire ADs for the reasons you just mentioned, Alan. They do a lot of different things besides just hire a football coach. My view with Scott is I think the board of trustees and I think the university administrators and those that work with him in that capacity as true bosses, if you will, from what I understand, I think they actually really like the job that Scott is largely doing. And therefore, I think he's going to get a lot of leeway. And for me, it's all going to be, your question for me is going to be how he handles Billy Napier's failure if he fails. If Napier is successful, Scott's here. Golden and Napier is successful. All of a sudden, we love him. If Napier fails, how does he handle the failure? If he hitches his wagon and Tyler Napier gives him all the resources, keeps on going, blows through, let's say, fans and boosters and people are really frustrated, we got to make a change, and he's like, no, stick with this guy. You give him one more year, he fails again. Then you might die with him, right? And that'll be up to Scott to decide how he wants to handle that. That's why he is the athletic director. Those are the hard decisions he'll have to make if things start to get to go in that direction. But I think he can either lose the neutrals right now that are undecided, or he can gain them. Certainly, I think some people are just always dead set against a college's athletic director. No matter what happens with football, they just fire him and get another one.
Well, because they're looking at, if you're firing the coach, should you be firing the athletic director?
Right, which I think is a really reductive and silly way to go. Because again, if I put you in charge of an organization, you have to hire 35 people. You're not going to get all 35 hires right. It's impossible. It's never going to happen. You're going to get some wrong. And if I give you a chance to hire football and we just do a quick mathematical calculation, take the top 25 schools, look at their football hires, give me the fire rate, it's really high. Mm-hmm. So then are you blaming that on your AD? Because the fire rate's really high, right? It's one thing if the success rate of a coach is like 90% and your AD's 0-2, you got to fire the guy. So there's a lot of factors, I think, that go on here. But for me, it's going to be how I think he handles it, because I think the public has a lot to do with ADs being fired. Nobody wants to hitch their wagon, if you're on the board of trustees or you're the UF president, to someone that's unpopular with the public. And I think right now, Scott, there's some people he's very unpopular with because Florida football has not been good. I think most people are undecided on him. I think that will swing depending on what happens. So that I go more with how it's handled. That's my own speculation. I have no obviously inside information what's happening there. But again, to your point, Alan, if we go 9-3, no one's talking about firing Scott mm-hmm. anymore, I think, for that regard.
Okay, let me read this one here. Michael Misconi asks, can you address a lot of the rumors and back and forth on the message boards? You know, I know you're a big message board person, James, that a big problem UF has with NIL is the structure of the UAA. A lot of people seem to think older guard types like Jeremy Foley, which I don't know how much influence he has anymore, don't believe in changing the way the UAA spends money, and that is hurting Florida in the NIL arms race.
Yeah, I'm going to defer this question. As most of you know, we have Scott on the podcast each year. We're hoping to have him back on again this season. There's a couple of questions we'd love to ask Scott, and this is definitely one of them. I'd also love to get Jeremy Foley on. Jeremy was instrumental in my early career when I worked for the athletic department, and then also after, and just helping me get on some boards and do other stuff. He's been a good person to know and be friends with. I think it'd also be great one day to maybe get him on here on the mic as well and kind of talk about how different it was in his era. But regardless, I think our hope here, Alan, I don't know is the answer. It's message board talk, and neither I nor Alan actually know what's going on with the structure of those things behind closed doors, aside from what you're hearing, we hear. So to opine on it right now would not add anything definitive to the conversation because we just don't know either. So hopefully we'll get the source directly on the pod, and then we'll be able to talk more directly as to what we think is going on structurally.
Well, let's talk about NIL for a second here. I think this is really difficult too. It's like, what what do you want your NIL future to be like? What do you think the future is of NIL is? Do you want to really push fans towards this thing that you think will be over in 2 years? We have players on contracts, or it's going to be a long time. Maybe we really do need to reorient. If it's in the short term, reorienting might be net negative. Maybe you're not as successful as you all want to be on the football field, but it's not as good for the overall future of your institutions. I don't know. There's real donor fatigue here too, right? That's become a word, and I get it. Like, the universities are raking in money, but they can't pay the players. So they're asking the fans have to pay the players, which if the universities are making no money, asking the fans to pay players, I think would be reasonable, maybe. But there's such a disconnect now, right? And I don't know. This is, we're in a position where it can't continue on indefinitely, and no one knows for certain which way it's going to go. So I think I would understand some hesitance to go to really apply heavy pressure, right? Florida's trying to do things in NIL, right? They're lining up people to promote it. You're seeing it with Florida Victorious and other things. So I don't know. I don't know what the future is. And if you're a leader trying to shape the future of organization in really uncertain times, there's not like a playbook of this is how you should do it. So there you go.
Okay, I like it. Stephen Coffer asks, do you think Strickland coming on multiple podcasts is his way of heading off potentially bad publicity by, quote, befriending the podcasters?
I don't think so. I mean, I think he is smart to say, this is a way that people get to hear me without a lot of filters, right? It's not just a news clip. They can hear me talk. I think it's just wise if you want to serve your constituents, right? So like Florida alumni and the institution, right? So let me communicate better. Better communication will always lead to better results. I think he probably intuitively understands, especially for most media, that those things aren't real friendships, right? We're not media, so we exist in a different world, but they're not going to hesitate to like skewer you no matter how nice you are, I think. I mean, there's some human element, but ultimately they're not getting paid to like be your friend. They're getting paid to like cover the sport. So I don't know. That feels like a losing game. I think he probably understands that. If it's to ward off negative publicity, if it's to help better communicate, I think it's a wise avenue.
Yeah, I think for the same reasons we encourage Billy to come on this podcast, mm-hmm. and we encourage Scott, you know, we're friends with Scott before we brought him on the podcast, obviously personal friends outside of the podcast and football world in general. You know, the reality of that is it's smart, as you said, to communicate your message out into the public, right? We live in a world where the media is going to give you an article with maybe 7 quotes on it, and you might have had a 30-minute conversation. So this allows the listener to hear what the person is saying and decide for themselves whether they think this leader is fit to lead. And so I think if you believe you're a competent leader, you want to go out and state your views and thoughts on how you run things. And I think that's wise, rather than allow other people to define what you're working on and what you're doing for you, when oftentimes that's not correct in the first place. So I don't think he's doing a charm campaign to try to get people on his side. I think if anything, he's probably trying to say, look, here's what's actually happening, and you can take it or leave it. It's your choice. That's kind of what the point of podcasting and spoken word stuff is in the first place, is state your narrative and we can decide whether or not we agree with it. And I think he's doing a wise thing by putting himself out there. I don't know his motives for it, but I happen to believe, you know, that he really cares about the University of Florida. He wants to succeed. He wants to win. He wants things to be great for everyone. And I think he's trying to articulate his ideas on a lot of these things.
Okay, CoolHand7 says, what are your thoughts regarding Dan Mullen's comments about stability, like giving a coach time versus getting rid of a coach every 3 years, facilities, etc.?
This just continues to show me how completely out of touch Dan Mullen is with the world that he now lives in. It's almost comical to me. We are now, as Nick Saban is going in front of politicians to discuss, in a world of complete transactional football, year to year, dollar for dollar, right? Payment for payment, which tells you that most of these college kids, in the words of Nick Saban himself, are basically just deciding who's paying them the most money. It's year to year. It's a year to year commitment. So why should we hold on to a coach for 10 years, facilities, et cetera, whatever, when it's a year-to-year sport? Because that's what it is now, right? And so I think what that means is, and we said this at the beginning of the NIL, Alan, you and I went on the podcast and I said, you know what's funny is the NIL is actually going to accelerate how fast we find out if someone can do this job. In large part for these reasons that are occurring right now. Because if you are skilled, you're going to very quickly find a way to rebuild a roster every single year. You're going to find a way to get people to support you financially. You're going to get your boosters to believe in what you're doing and they're going to want to invest in you because they want to win. And look, I hate the system. We're going to talk about NIL in a second in general. But for me, the counter argument to this is so simple. If what Mullen said were true, then these coaches that you get rid of too quickly would start dominating in their next job or their next job. And it almost never happens. The guys who have success relatively quickly at the top level are the ones who stay there. So for me, I feel very comfortable saying, no, if you give a guy 3 years and he can't get it done, he's not good enough. Because history tells us that's almost without equivocation the correct way to go. And giving a coach more time in an era of complete transactional monetary pay football is not the way to go. You and I both have, of course, Alan, they find ways to fix this. Now, when you get to contracts, you might change your mind on how you view coaches. But in this current landscape, I don't think that comment makes any sense.
Well, it just ends up sounding like sour grapes. And I don't know. I mean, maybe I'd have sour grapes too if I got fired. But I do think there's something to be said about like patience and not being reactionary. Right. So if the trajectory is going up and you're impatient, you will cut yourself off at the knees because you won't give things time to develop. Right. I don't think firing a coach every year would be anyone's, you know, path forward. And so if you feel like your fan base is or your administration is reactionary, that's not good. But as you said, it's usually pretty clear after 3 years or so, what is that person's timeline and can they excel and should I be giving them more time? And again, I think the last few years, Billy Napier has had to weather some really interesting things. I don't think we've always agreed with every choice, but I'm in favor of stability overall. I think that's better than instability, right? Of course. So Dan Mullen's trajectory was going down. So I think that was his main problem is if he was continually improving every year and Florida fired him because it wasn't fast enough, I think you would have an argument. You'd say, guys, we were heading into like great success and you just got impatient. But when the trajectory starts to go down, and not just on the field, but in recruiting and every aspect of the organization, then you can go, okay, the arrow's not pointing up. If the arrow's pointing up for somebody and you go, nah, not fast enough, I think you could deserve some blame. Okay. Dr. Eyeball is back and wants to know, when is it time to hire a new AD? He's genuinely curious. He's not trolling here, I guess.
Aside from the obvious reasons, scandal, you know, improper behavior, whatever, right? I think the answer is when you lose faith and trust in that person doing what's best for the university at a skillful level. Of course, almost every AD is trying to do what's best. But when you lose trust that they are capable of doing what's best with their skill set, right? And that can be in a variety of facets. If it's really important for you to be able to raise funds to take your athletic department from here to here and that person is incapable of doing it, you have to get rid of them. If it's, you know, whatever related, imagine a scenario that I just gave you, then you have to get rid of them, right? Just like any other job. Obviously, if you have an AD, again, who I think sticks their neck out for a certain coach in a high revenue sport like football and they go against the grain and they bet their career on that and they're wrong, then you have to get rid of them. That's a bet they made. That's where they made their bed, right? But you know, outside of that, I think you want to be careful and you want to holistically, again, evaluate their job while recognizing that football at the University of Florida is responsible for 90%+ of the revenue the entire athletic department generates. Basketball is responsible for the remaining 10% or so. No other sport makes a single dollar that adds to the bottom line. So you have to get that right. You're running a business that essentially is a one revenue item, right? It's a one product offering. and you have to get that right. So if you lose faith and you go into the next hiring cycle saying, I've lost faith in this AD, I don't think he will choose the right guy, then you must get rid of him. I think if you believe this person was reasonable and rational, they've hired this person and that person, I've seen their methodology and system, they're using a team of people during the search process to identify candidates. I believe that, you know, if they get three shots at it, one out of three are going to be right, which is about the right number, then you give them another shot. So I think the answer is simple, though. It's when you lose faith in their ability to be able to do it. And that faith loss needs to be rooted in objectivity rather than an emotional feeling of a recent failure. And you can have recency bias and get rid of someone or elevate someone at too high of a station based upon past results that were, you know, recent, rather than relatively objectively saying, is this person doing things that were probable and good and most likely to be right and had a failure? If so, let's keep going. If they are not, then I think you have to go in a different direction.
Right. I like everything you just said, just to color around the edges, process oriented, right? Was it, there are some hires and everyone goes, oof, that was a terrible hire and it goes terribly. You have to go, yeah, what was your process that led you to that hire? If someone makes a hire that everyone thought is great, what, you know, at the time, Lincoln Riley to USC, if everyone's like, wow, what a great hire. If it doesn't work, is the guy an idiot who did it? Right? So there's guys like, you know, when Kansas hired Lance Leipold, it wasn't like everyone's like, oh, you did it. You found him. But he's been really successful. That process was good, obviously. But there's no guarantees in this, right? So I don't know. I like the process that led to Billy Napier. If he's not the right guy and the process is sound, I don't know what else you would want from a person.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll give the mathematical example. And this is, we can't know this, but let's say that you have identified the best process and you're flipping coins and, you know, you have coins that are weighted unevenly. So one coin flips 70%, one flips 60%, one flips 50% of the time on heads, Alan. And I say to you as a leader of the organization, every day you get one choice of which coin to pick and you need to flip heads. Which coin are you choosing? And if you say to me, I'm going to pick the heads coin that flips 70% every single day, I'm going to say, great, you're my guy. That's correct. Knowing full well that the 50% coin could beat you 10 or 12 days in a row. That is relatively possible mathematically. It's very possible you're going to lose 3 days in a row with the best strategy. So the real question is Alan taking the best strategy? And if he is, I'm good. I'll ride with the adverse results, knowing that's part of the process. If he's taking a strategy that's not the best, then you say, okay, you know, that's not ideal. And that's overly simplified, but I think that's what you're trying to do.
Yes.
Is you're trying to view it in a lens like that. And that's where we're going with that. All right, NIL, a hard turn here, but not really. Jeffrey Hoy says, if you could implement any rules you wanted for the NIL and the transfer portal, what would they be? And we've touched on this before in the past, but nice now to kind of summarize and be where we are.
He also asked, do you think college football is beyond repair?
I was going to save that one for after you gave your fix.
You know, I think now it's hard to see a way where you don't have contracts because the NCAA has been defeated at every turn. Right. So if there's free player movement and even someone like Caden Proctor who can go from Iowa to Alabama to Iowa and then back to Alabama
in the span of 3 months.
Yeah. And there's multi-time transfers and you have no ability to invest or plan. It's just untenable. I don't know. There's a lot of things when you talking about Olympic sports and I think the thing that's been unleashed now will have significant negative consequences to something. We might fix football and destroy everything else. I don't know if that will be what happened. But I think contractually obligated players is really the only way forward. I don't know how you quite achieve that. And then maybe the portal then doesn't exist. So I don't know if you're allowed to trade players. Maybe not. I would also be okay if people could sign and it was actually binding. The whole recruiting calendar I would totally redo as well. Let people sign before their senior year. If a coach gets fired, they're released from their commitment. But yeah, just the way everything is shaking out now is just pure chaos.
Yeah, the answer to this is really simple because in the free market, we already know exactly how to run professional sporting leagues that involve paying players. And this is what we're doing in college football, just without all the things that we've learned over 100 plus years of running professional sports leagues across the world. It's like taking all those lessons and using none of them because we can't. And that's where we are. So is college football beyond repair? Yes, until we create a structure, a new structure that allows for us to take all the things we've learned in running professional sports across the world for 100 years and use them for a cohesive and normally running league. Until that point in time, we're all screwed, which we've talked about. The hope is everyone seems to be aware of this and they're all trying to get their heads together to figure out how quickly can we get to something that involves contracts. Something, of course, you and I talked about from day one of the NIL. We were going to go in this direction. It was going to derail. It was going to suck. And here we are. So I think that's simple. And to your point, the funny thing about the transfer portal is, yeah, there will not be one, just like there's not one in the NFL. But you will have a free agency period, which, of course, this year in the NFL, a league I love, it was one of the more active free agency periods in a long time. Lots of marquee players switching names. It doesn't feel dirty or wrong for the most part, even if you don't like seeing your favorite player leave, because they have a contract that ended. Their team could have tried to re-sign them. Other teams went for them. It's just a lot better. And you don't have them turning around 6 months later and going back to their team, right?
So you
got to go with that.
So it's funny. You have to have ability to have player movement on some level. Otherwise, you get to the situation where you have the NBA where they're under contract and they just whine until they get traded. And the guy's signing contracts and then immediately going 3 months later, trade me. So that's a cultural problem where they have more power than their contract would stipulate, but I don't know. So there's no perfect system.
No, there's trade-offs. But you take the lessons you learn. Yes. You look at European soccer, I think, where you have transfer fees. You have your team. Basically, Alan, your team has to be rewarded for taking a risk on a player, mm-hmm. for signing them, developing them. And if they want to trade them or they want to, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think in college football, you would not have trades most likely, at least early on. Now, if they create these super leagues, 40 teams, etc., you could absolutely have trades, something you could totally do.
So not trades, but transfer soccer style.
Right. But yeah, but essentially that's a trade, right? My team contacts your team. And right. So basically, I think that's what would happen. Again, I'm a big fan, I have been, of the European soccer model for college football for a lot of reasons. I think it makes the most sense because you're mixing so much raw development where a lot of guys won't make it with guys who will. And that's exactly what happens already. And it works, and it's worked for a long time, and it works for the players that are young, and it works for the players that are accomplished. And there's no perfect system, obviously, but that one has worked. You know, why reinvent the wheel? But basically, I think, Jeffrey, both of us are saying, yeah, college football in the current state it's in is completely busted. Everyone knows it. And it would be beyond repair without a destruction of what we have and a rebuilding of what we have. And that is not going to be easy, as we've alluded to. All right, Daniel Flood says, some high-profile boosters, specifically Hal Lewis, have started a new strategy of blaming fans. There's a tweet recently about his Florida Victoria post where, like, you know, 18,000 people saw it and 8 people contributed. This is our problem. Is this new strategy a good one to bring donors in by basically drawing attention to the fact that, hey, a lot of people are seeing this stuff, but you're not contributing. We can't sign players without the money.
I don't think guilt is ever a good long-term strategy. You have to align people's interests. So I understand, though. I don't give to Florida Victorious. I just don't think it's a healthy avenue for my finances. And I recognize that my team might suffer for it. But I don't know. It feels like it's the wrong way to go about it. There's just a flaw in the system. It's hard to be supportive of the system itself.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot. I'll just say it in like 2 sentences. I'm an investor professionally, right? So it's literally absurdly ludicrous to ask people to fund something that they get no return on investment from whatsoever. And also, it is not a charity. So people contribute to art museums all the time. They contribute to charitable functions they want to have and they want to see well because they think there's a community good to it. Mm-hmm. This, no matter how you convince yourself, is paying kids to win football games where you get some intrinsic value of winning more football games as a fan. But that is very uncompelling compared to the majority of ways people actually invest their money, their free discretionary cash, right? Where it's going to give a much higher return. So I think this is what's hard, is it's just hard. In the state of Florida, and Florida fans in general, are not as interested in playing the booster game as other schools have been. We got a buddy in Chris Musgrove. He's co-host of the podcast before he goes to Auburn, and he tells the story of growing up in Alabama and in general being in that environment in Alabama when he's there. It's like the oldest sport is competing for these athletes to sign between Bama and Auburn, and they love it. It's cachet. It's status in their town. In Florida, you don't have a lot of status if you're giving lots of money to the athletic program. Most Florida grads aren't looking at you like you're a hero. You're not going around their community saying, look at me, I'm the biggest booster. There's some cachet there, but Florida alums, that just doesn't move the needle for them. And so I think we're fighting, in my opinion, an impossible battle at a school like Florida to where a lot of graduates are going to feel great about funding this program. It's just not how we are. And I don't care how well you run it. I just think it's going to be hard to find dollars for it. Maybe if you get a coach where people really believe in them and they want to win a title, you get some boost in investment. So, okay, I want to win one. I'm sick of losing, whatever. But you said it best at the beginning. The incentives are not aligned.
And it's too...
That's the problem.
It's too short-term and it's too gambling. Like, if you know, like, hey, if I give this amount of money, we'll win one more game. That's like, okay, that's interesting. Right? But it's all speculative. So that's another reason why I think it's hard to get people aligned there. Okay. Moving towards our last two sections here, a special section on tactics, right? This is a good one.
I like that we've never had a section on tactics in this mailbag before.
Russell and Vicky Hall ask, maybe too in-depth for a mailbag app. Well, guess not. We're talking about it. But I'd love to hear a discussion of the mechanics of changing a play call at the line, especially when personnel grouping doesn't match the formation, i.e. normal down situation, the defense is a nickel, but after you line up, they stack the box with nine guys and there's a run play called. What level of recognition and communication does it take to switch to a pass play that takes advantage of that situation, especially with limited time on the play clock?
All right, let's start first with the NFL. So obviously in the NFL, if you have a veteran quarterback of any kind, then you have your play call. Sometimes you have two play calls you go with, and you'll hear these guys say kill, 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 and they'll go to the other one. If you're a play caller who's been around for a while, you have full control of the offense. If you have enough time on the play clock, you can change the play entirely. You'll hear a check call. You'll hear a new call come out at the line, and then you'll go to the new play, and you'll often see them even shift their formation. I mean, a wholesale change to a different look is within your persona. Billy, now back to college, wants to do that. He wants to give Graham Mertz the full ability to go from play A to play F instead of just play A to play B, which again, most colleges are going to have play A to play B. In college, typically the guy in the booth calls the play, quarterback goes down, it's signaled in, right? And then he's going to create kind of a dummy look to see if the defense shows what they're in, a pressure or something else. Then he'll go to the real play. The real quarterback may only have one late kill, 5 seconds in the clock left to go. If something looks really bad, kill, go to run, right? So it depends on what you're doing. But Billy, to answer your question, defense is a nickel, you line up, now all of a sudden they're stacked, there's a run play called. The quarterback has full control. And immediately in that scenario, you're trying to hit him with a shot play, right? You're going to go with a quick hitter vert, fade route, go route, slant route, something quick where you know they're going to bring pressure and you want to wind up taking advantage of a man-to-man scenario or hit an empty place where the pressure comes from. But you have full control of that with your system in Florida. And that's one of the things I think quarterbacks like about Billy's system is they do give the quarterback a ton of play calling control. And Billy wants his quarterbacks to be able to identify all of that. And it does take a cerebral, obviously, quarterback to do it. So great question. But at Florida, the answer is theoretically, you can go to play F. Other schools, again, you might have just a play B. And sometimes with a freshman quarterback doesn't know what he's doing, he just runs the play. And you'll see all of that on display on Saturdays.
And again, you have to have enough time to make that switch if the play call.
Correct. And that's why you hear me complain so much about Billy's play calls coming in late. Me as a play caller, I want to get to the line as soon as possible. And that's why I like what Heupel does at Tennessee. You notice them, they're at the line fast, largely so Heupel can quickly decide what they're in. They have wide splits. It's easy to see what the defense is in. It's hard to pressure in football from that regard. And then he can easily get a good look in route combination wise to his quarterbacks. That's again, to me, it's a layup reason why you want to get to the line faster to give yourself more time to diagnose what the defense is doing.
All right. Bert Bill wants to know, James, why are the hash marks different in college and pro? What effect do they have on how the games are played?
This is a great question. So in, I think, the 70s, pro football switched to narrower hash marks in large part to open up the game more as the game became more passing oriented. The reason that opens up the game more is obviously if the hash marks are more narrow, you're more in the middle of the field and it's easier to pass to the left and to the right instead of going into the boundary. In college, if you're on the far hash, you're very close to that boundary side of the field, the short side of the field, and it's very difficult. You can't run a lot of concepts in there. It does also make it easier to run offense and score because you have the wide side of the field, and essentially for defenses, it's much harder for them to disguise what they're doing on the wide side of the field because they have the long way to run. You want to bring a nickel blitz from the wide side and you've got your receiver, you know, pretty far away from you. That guy's never going to get to your quarterback, and that's a wide open throw. There are a lot of coaches that would love to see, college coaches that would love to see college go to narrower hash marks for the reasons I just mentioned. One, it is actually better for defenses schematically to bring pressure, but two, as a passing team, it does not force you into weird scenarios where you have a really short side of the field. So the answer is a significant effect on the game of football. Very significant. In fact, a lot of quarterbacks transitioning from college to the NFL, one of the hardest issues they have are the hash marks because they don't get as many easy throws to the wide side of the field. And again, those pressures can be extremely confusing. They're much easier to disguise if you have center hash marks. So a lot is different. Big effect in general. The ones I gave you are there, and hopefully that helps.
All right, you want to do the next one?
Yeah, Sandy Derrick says, you're the head coach, Alan. Would you prefer having your coordinators in the field or on the sideline?
This is always a thing that if it's not working, you move the guy from the field to the box. I don't know if there's a pure answer to this. I would think I would want my offensive coordinator at least in the box. I'd want him to have a bird's eye view of what's going on. The defensive coordinator, I feel like for some reason that there's a little more leeway, right? So you're a little more maybe strategic and less tactical play to play. But you want to have a guy in the box, obviously, who you're communicating with. But I don't know. I don't know if that's just my intuition, but I don't know if that's actually true.
Yeah, I think for myself, if I'm a coordinator, I would prefer, and I love like field level atmosphere, but I prefer to be in the box because it's like watching the All-22. It is just so much easier to see what teams are doing. Mm-hmm. On-field coordinators, oftentimes, you can see, you get a feel for it, you know what's going on, you watch them shift, but there is definitely, I think, a more of a chess matchy view from the box where you're sort of free to just focus on the pieces. As a head coach, though, my answer would be pretty simple here. I'd want my coordinators where they feel like they can do the best. And coaches are different. Hey, look, if you feel like you're best in the sideline box, it's where you just see and feel things and you get an idea for it, then I'm going to put you there. And if you prefer to be in the skybox or up in the box box, then hey, I'm going to put you there.
Sure. Especially the reason I thought even DC, if you're trying to communicate with players individually.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Whether what they're doing tactically or even motivation-wise, if that felt like a need for you, then there's obviously some benefit there.
Yeah, and I think what you see like in the NFL, obviously with, you know, like Shanahan, right? These guys are going to call plays in the NFL, Andy Reid, et cetera, is they have a guy in the box. And oftentimes they're communicating in the headset, hey, here's the play. I like this look. You know, what did you see when we put this look in before? And they'll tell you. So they're getting the intel from the box, but they're there on the sideline to talk to the quarterback, et cetera, whatever. So for me, it's all about where that person wants to be. I think that's the key. And I wouldn't care either way. But to your point, I'm glad you pointed out that sometimes teams start playing the game of like, we're going to put them up here, we're going to put them on there. That always seems to be pretty bad. Those guys have coached long enough to know that doesn't really matter. It's a preference. And when you're doing that, you're kind of grasping at straws. All right. Now we're in the miscellaneous section.
Some fun questions here.
Yeah, these are good. This is just a random smorgasbord of good times here to close out this mailbag. I'm pretty excited about it. We'll start with Justin Wood. Who are some hot named coaches that you know of, Alan, besides the usual suspects, which he's naming CJ Kenny at Texas State and Jamie Chadwell and John Summerall?
You know, it feels like the player movement or the coach movement, the coach carousel, like move pretty quickly there. I don't have anybody that I'm looking at this season other than those guys that you named that I'm super intrigued about. I was trying to come up with a guy. The guy that is... Of those three, even the guy that I'm most interested in is Jamie Chadwell. Like, there was some question, like, is this just an isolated incident where he's doing this at Coastal Carolina? Went to Liberty and they were immediately good. Now, they're good under Hugh Freeze too, but I don't know. There's something about this. I love the trend of taking a guy like that, or you're seeing if someone is uber, uber successful, like Kalen DeBoer. Lance Leipold as well, was at Wisconsin Whitewater for forever. If I'm a smaller, more out of the way place, I'm definitely hiring one of the, if there's a guy who's a complete outlier success wise, I am definitely hiring him and seeing what he can do. And so that's not a name, but that's a path that I'm really interested in right now, because we've seen some of these guys be really successful. I mean, Chris Kleiman at Kansas State. Usually if you're a good football coach, you're going to win almost any environment.
Yeah, that's the key. And again, all those guys you're mentioning had a lot of, as you said, track record success at the places they were at. And I think it's important. Gustav Cross, I've always been curious as to why quarterbacks listed, the ones he lists below, have not panned out at Florida. So he's got Driscoll as a five-star. Brantley, highly thought of, was close to a five-star. Jacoby Brissett, who was also a highly ranked guy, obviously, became a long-term NFL quarterback, still is in the NFL, transferred, had a good career. Now, why are these guys, why were they not successful, essentially, at Florida, in your opinion?
Well, I think Driscoll's the easiest one to answer. He was a pure spread kind of guy, and we brought him in and completely changed what we were doing with him. And it took him a long time to, like, figure out, you know. And again, he played in the NFL for – he might still
he's
be
still
in the NFL.
He's still in the NFL. He is right. Still in the NFL, and so is Brissett. So those are two guys that were on the same team, basically.
I think Brantley's just a miss, right? You know,
he just is a total miss.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happens too. So I think Florida, Driscoll was a case where, you know, we just wrong time, wrong place. If Urban Meyer and Dan Mullen stay there, I think he probably puts up crazy numbers. But that's not what happened to him. And Jacoby Brissett, he's a good quarterback, just kind of chose the wrong guy over him, or a different guy than him.
Yeah, that's for sure. I remember really wanting Jacoby to play. This is before the pod in that scenario. But, you know, what's funny here is, if you're a fan of any team that is in the championship caliber tier historically, you can name several guys that this is the same exercise with. And I think what that tells you is, again, these are high school kids. You forecast them based upon their ceiling level talent and what they're doing now. But when they get into the next level, you don't know if they're going to make it or not. And you don't know if it's going to take them a while, or if your coaching staff might mess them up with the wrong system. There's so many variables at play that, again, every school you can look at can name five stars who got away, guys who transferred, didn't select the right guy. Obviously, Joe Burrow, Ohio State, is one that comes to mind for a lot of people, right? But there's plenty of that goes on. So I think this is not special to Florida. I think in Florida, we recall these more poignantly because we're in a quarterback desert, really, right, until Kyle Trask, for a long time, of just like, what is going on? And we just couldn't get it right. And if we had a good guy, it was, you know, Ligandrol that left him out of there. It was, you know, transfer stuff or whatever. We selected the wrong guy. We just couldn't hit it. But I think that's relatively consistent across the board for most quality teams. Robert Davies asks, he asks you specifically here, Alan, considering the recent arrest of one Trevor Etienne, the lack of priority playing time at Florida, was that any way related to his own behavior, perhaps? Again, he just got arrested. This is maybe last night, two nights ago, for a DUI at 4:35 in the morning. That's making the news. You haven't heard it yet. So in Georgia, he gets arrested up there.
I have no way of knowing this. There's not been any. You never heard any bad things about
Trevor. Seems unlikely.
Trevor. This next question is maybe even more interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to say seems unlikely, Robert. Yeah. We never heard that. No one ever said that. He seemed like a kid who was working hard and was not behaviorally doing things. All right, J.D. Hutchinson asks, piggyback question. Does Athens have a culture of recklessly driving, or are reckless drivers just attracted to Northeast Georgia?
So this has just been true of Georgia recently, very high profile. There probably is a question, if I was at Georgia, I would want to ask. Like, is our culture promoting this either directly or indirectly? Some of our best players have gotten busted for this. Are there lots of other guys who are doing this as well? Of course, you have that many young guys in a college town, someone getting arrested for a DUI is not surprising, but there has been enough of these now over the recent time span that if I'm Kirby Smart, I would want to lean into this pretty heavily.
Yeah. And how do you lean into it? Because I think the traditional thought is it's how you punish, right?
Well, it's how you punish. I think you probably become more active. I have no idea whether he's doing so. You more proactively talk about it. You do things to create a different kind of culture around it. And I think you do punish differently too. So again, a one-off thing, you just go, I don't know, guy got drunk and made a stupid choice. There's plenty of people who do that all the time. but I would want to know if there's something in my culture that's promoting this. Okay, these last ones are all for you. I can opine a little bit, but Michael Moscone asked James, as a fellow Dolphins fan, thoughts on Tua and McDaniel going into year three?
I love McDaniel. I could not. I mean, McDaniel's offense was therapeutic relief every Sunday for me, because the guy, I think, has his finger all over the pulse of football. He's so creative. He's maximizing his resources. He's making a guy in Tua, who I think is a very pedestrian level quarterback, look good in the system, which then tells you my thoughts on Tua. I don't think Tua is capable of winning a title. I think he's in the best possible fit he could have with two of the best receivers at the same time on a football team in Waddle and in Tyreek. And he struggles mightily when it's third down and 7 or 8, when he can't release the ball in 1.5 seconds. You know, the Dolphins were unlucky with injuries last year, I think, which really hurt them. That was kind of their year. I felt like they had a good enough roster to win it, but I'm sky high on McDaniel. I'd love to see the Dolphins pair him with a higher ceiling quarterback. Of course, the NFL right now is having a quarterback sort of pandemic or epidemic, where it's really difficult to find quality quarterbacks in general. The guys coming out of college are failing at a higher rate than normal. So those are spitball thoughts, but I am not on the Tua train, and
you would not pay Tua
over the McDaniel train. I wouldn't want to pay him top 15 money. I'd sit down with them and want to say, look, I mean, you've done a lot here, but you know, the numbers are just really not good versus defenses that are quality throughout his career in games that matter. I put a lot of emphasis on that, but I think you're stuck as a Dolphins fan. I certainly don't want to go through the quarterback desert for 10 years, right? Like, Tua is serviceable. You can win games with him. I don't want to get rid of him for nothing. What do you do? That's why it's hard. He's going to want to get paid. His numbers are there because of McDaniel and the prolific receivers he has. But long story short, Alan, put Tua on half of the other NFL teams. And do you think that he all of a sudden is like really upgrading them? Or how much of this is a Dolphins perfect scenario?
Right. I would not want to tie myself financially to him. I'd rather roll the dice on, like, you know, whatever the backup quarterback du jour is, you know, Sam Darnold, and fire some bullets in the draft. I would much rather do that.
Yeah, I'm with you there. So I think for the Dolphins, again, sky high on McDaniel.
And some people are not that high on old Trevor Lawrence, and I think that is some noise in the system. Whatever the contract is, sign him up for it. That's my opinion.
Yeah. We should ask you one question. No one asked you. I'm going to ask you a mailbag question.
Okay.
Mac Jones?
I think it's overpaying for a backup. I think we got our backup quarterback performance last year left a lot to be desired. And you know, you're kind of buying low on him. I think a way overpay for, you know, a 6-round pick. You didn't need to do that, but in the end, it's not that big a deal.
Okay. Not that big a deal. No concern that there's questions about Trevor Lawrence
and you want to bring in.
Okay. Just making sure.
Okay. I just thought, hey, there's a starting quarterback.
Yeah.
Who you can have for a late 6-round pick.
Right.
And we think we're going to be good next year, and we don't want...
You want some insurance.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, Gavin Boucher wants to know, what products does JDV use in that hair?
Yeah, well, one thing is I love that my moniker is JDV.
It's a great one.
Because in reality, it's JDD, because D Virgilio is D-I space, then Virgilio. But it is my last initial is D and not V. But I like that JDV
has become
the rallying cry, and I'm not opposing it. I'm leaning into it. Secondarily, great question, obviously, and I'll give you the real answer just to humor you there, Gavin. I know it's a troll question, but we're here to answer all things authentically.
You might really want to know.
Yeah. There's a glorious product by Kevin Murphy named Knight Rider. Yeah, that's right. It's amazing. Australian company, phenomenal. It's like a dry matte pomade product, and then I use a dry texturizer, which is like best being described like snowflakes hitting your hair.
Okay.
And that dry keeps your your hair nice and dry and texturized and thick and flowy. So if you've got a mane of hair and you want to get some flow, there's your flow advice.
Could you do like one of those TikToks where you like get ready in the morning and show everyone your routine?
I can't believe we live in a world where that's like a thing where people get lots of views on, you know. But yeah, hilarious, Gavin. I'm glad I can answer that for you. Thank you.
All right. Ian Hazard says, I want to hear James talk about his strategy in the West Side Flag Football League. He's probably joking too, but
he is joking, but that's our city league here that we play in the spring right now for Sevens Flag. And I love that you're joking about this, Ian. It's great. In a nutshell, very quickly, for those of you that are new, I favor a 3 quarterback offense.
Yeah. Google it.
Yeah, it's there. So we run three quarterbacks. I'm the middle quarterback. I have two guys that are flanking me with wide splits like Tennessee, two receivers that are flanked out all the way to the sideline, a slot receiver, and then a center. And we spread the field maximally east and west and north and south. On defense, we're multiple. So we'll run cover two, cover three, cover one. We'll shift post-snap. We'll bring one rusher, bring two. And generally speaking, reductively, the goal of flag football on offense is to buy time for your quarterback so you can make high percentage throws. And on defense, it's to take time away from the opposing quarterback. There you go.
I like it. That was great. This is an elevator pitch.
There's the nutshell. I can't. This question is my favorite. We said it for last because, I mean, I can't. I love it.
I have no way to speak.
I can't believe
someone
asked this, but I love it.
All right. Perpetually Sage UF fan. Why does Greg Berhalter suck? And if you don't know who Greg Berhalter is, he's the coach of the men's U.S. soccer team.
Greg Berhalter, also known as Triple G. I said this. I couldn't believe this is a question. I just said this last night when I was talking with some guys. We watched U.S. beat Mexico last night in the CONCACAF Nations League championship game 2-0. Mexico is not really good anymore. It's still a good win for the U.S. The U.S. is, I think, the most talented they've ever been. Quite objectively in our time. I've been to two World Cups. I love the U.S. national team. It's my favorite sporting event to go to when it's World Cup time. And therefore, I declared Greg Berhalter to be the coach that I have liked the least in my entire history of being alive for any team I've had, which is a big statement. But I cannot stand this guy. And so I love that you're already teeing me up with a question that says he sucks. And the reason that he sucks, A, his track record sucks. He's never been a good coach anywhere, number one. Number two, he's existing in an ecosystem of the U.S. national team, which is basically a crony cartel supporting the MLS and trying to win like it's the 1980s and 90s, where newsflash, Alan, we didn't win and we were not good at soccer. So we've got the old guard who can't see the future and is not innovative, hiring a coach who is the least innovative, most conservative, uninspiring person you can imagine who's only ever failed. And now his crowning achievement is continually beating the worst Mexico team in my lifetime over and over again, only to cataclysmically fail when he plays good teams and I think get underproductive results from his highly talented roster. All that being said, the simple problem with the U.S. national team is this. Until we get a cleaning of the front house, we get imaginative leaders and an imaginative coach who sees the future, who sees how to use the U.S. team's national resources and players to go from here to where we need to get to, and does not see it as a, we're going to take this very conservative, how we used to win American style and make that something, we're screwed. And Greg Berhalter is the poster child for the conservative, lame sauce way to play soccer, quote, the American way, uninspiring, not a good coach, has no idea what he's doing tactically, and he is the head of our greatest generation thus far. So that's why he sucks, and that's why I dislike him. And it makes me so sad because I love the U.S. national team so freaking much. And I have zero confidence in our leader, and we're hosting the World Cup in America. And I am just tragically sad about it.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a chance they might part ways with him for a minute there. And
yeah, he was gone for a year. I thought, this is it. I was so happy. I was like, renewed excitement. And I mean, I do think, Alan, this is the end. I think with this World Cup, this will end. I think we'll underperform on home soil. I think we will get a result that's not nearly as good as we should yet, given our talent. And I think everyone will clear out. And hopefully then we begin to become serious on the major soccer stage, which I can only hope happens. But until then, I'm stuck with Greg Berhalter. Even just reading his name and looking at it makes me upset.
All right. That's the end. Thank you guys so much for your questions. You guys sent some great questions in here in the last 24 hours. We'll probably do a little bit of this again in May. So if you've got more questions lined up, you can hold them for then. So the UF spring game is April 13th at 1 p.m., if you didn't know that. And so we're going to do a pod right after that. And, you know, obviously we talked about spring football is, you know, it's not the clearest picture, but it is a fun thing to talk about. It's back on Saturdays at 1, which is great for people with families and hopefully good for UF football. And we'll be back on that Monday. Anything else, James, for you?
No, great to be back with you, Alan. So much fun. We hope you guys enjoyed this mailbag segment. We're sorry in the off season that you only get once a month from us, but we love doing it. We love being with you. And look, it'll be less than a month. It's only really 3 weeks.
Yeah, coming up quick. With you. All right. And with that, let's close it out. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Go Gators.